What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal points and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyers in the house.
Welcome in Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. The Legal Eagles are in the studio and they're ready to close out the final show of 2015. Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. I'm Sam Paniatovic. Plenty to get to today. Legislation to recall Rahm Emanuel, the Freddie Gray jury. We may have a situation here. The Fisher versus the University of Texas affirmative action. We'll talk some change. And then we'll talk about some Korean literature coming up in the show. But we start with the bill to recall Rahm Emanuel. And that was really thrown into play by State Rep. LaShawn K. Ford from the 8th District. And he joins us now on WGN. Good morning.
Good morning, and I'm very happy to be on the show. The last show, did you say, for 2015?
You forgot the year already?
Yes. Man, it's gone that fast.
Yeah, that's it, closing off the year. So we appreciate you calling in, Representative. So we're talking about your bill to recall Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Could you give us a little bit of background as to why you've proposed that?
Yeah, I think it's been proposed as good public policy over 25, I believe, about 38 states have recalled for the mayor. And during a time of unrest where the community is looking for a way to hold the mayor accountable for what he was sworn to do, and we thought that it was just the best thing to do. When I say we, Representative Flowers is also a chief co-sponsor. Leader Ron Sandek is a chief co-sponsor. You have Jenny Ives, Republican, is a chief co-sponsor, and Jamie Andrade, representatives. We all agree that this is a good public policy that should be on the books for the people of Chicago.
All right, so I looked up the law. It's the Revised Cities and Villages Act of 1941. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that says that there is no provision not only for Chicago, right, but for any mayor in the state to be recalled. Is that your understanding?
That's exactly right. And this election law has not been visited since 1941. There has been no amendments to it.
Yeah, so, I mean, regardless of how you feel about Rahm's performance and about the Laquan McDonald case, Barbara Bird Bennett, you know, I think, I don't know, my perspective is it is a little strange to not be able to have some recall power if the mayor or any elected official, you know, is not doing their job. I mean, it's one thing to wait until an election. I think there's some merit to that. But, you know, most democracies do have some recall provision between elections. Isn't that true?
That's right. I mean, at least we passed a recall for the governor in 2010. So Illinois, we have a recall for the governor. But there's no recall for the mayor of a big city like Chicago. Chicago is a huge city. And Chicago, although it generates a lot of tax revenue from the taxpayers, it also eats up a lot of taxes from the crime that's committed in this city, the number of people that's incarcerated and their return and depend on services from the city that really have no ability to put back in. You know, just think about the $531 million that the city has paid out for wrongful, for police misconduct. That's amazing. So those are taxpayer dollars.
Representative, is there any precedence or is there any other state that you look to when you draft this bill in order to have some guidance on it?
You know, I looked at the NCSL, and NCSL has some guidance. That's the National Conference of State Legislators. And so they've provided guidance, plus We also did this in 2010 for our governor. For any governor that's sitting in the office, there is a recall mechanism for the voters.
Representative LaShawn Ford from the 8th Legislative District joining us here on Legal Face-Off on WGN+. You mentioned the $500 million-plus settlements that have been paid out by the city of Chicago to resolve alleged police brutality. Why not recall the alderman who signed off on these settlements almost sight unseen? Why not take them on?
I appreciate that question, and I appreciate the way you ask the question, because that's an excellent question. When you think about why not recall the aldermen, well, the aldermen, there are 50 of them, and when you think about the power that each of them, each of the aldermen have, and the impact that their power has on the city, it's very checked. The power lies in the executive office, where we have a strong mayor. Of course, the aldermen may have not done their due diligence to make sure that they were spending taxpayer dollars properly, but I don't know if that constitutes for taxpayers paying for a recall for 50 aldermen. It's an expensive task to take on, and we have an election that will be coming up for aldermen. That's the same thing with state reps. I mean, we, as state reps, we're sworn in January, and we do petitions in August. And we're checked by a number of our colleagues. So the governor has the power. The mayor has the power. You know, we are legislators, and we don't have as much power to hurt the public as the executive branches.
Representative, what about impeachment? That is different from a recall. You can impeach the president. Can you impeach the mayor of Chicago?
I've done some research on that, and I think that the process of impeachment is not available for city council. I thought that it was, but when I dig deep and look, and I say, well, I can't find it, and it's probably no doubt that there's no way that the impeachment can happen in the city of Chicago when we had two mayors. Mayor Daley, that ran the city for so long, there's no impeachment.
Yeah, I mean, clearly this is the result of Chicago, the idea that you can't really do anything with a mayor between elections is the result of, you know, the Daley father and son, you know, establishing that job is an incredibly strong position. But what would happen hypothetically if we had a mayor who was convicted of a crime? I mean, what if we had a mayor today who was, you know, stealing or was soliciting a prostitute or something else? What would we do?
Yeah, so I think that we would have to wait for the mayor to be convicted of that crime in order for him to have to be removed from office, because I'm not sure if the statute for being mayor, if you can even be a felon and be the mayor. Now, that's something that's a good question. But if he or she is under an investigation or have some serious allegations that is probably true, and you can't recall them, you can't do anything, he or she would just stay there.
With the current process, too, isn't it the only way they can get it done is if city council passes the bill, but then the mayor has to sign it? He's not going to sign his own death wish.
Well, no, he doesn't have to sign it. We have to have two aldermen to sign on to it. And so we have to get an organization, XYZ, will lead the petition drive after it passes the state legislature. And two aldermen have to sign on in order for the petitions to be certified with the Board of Elections. And then a special recall election is called.
Representative, how's the support on the bill? Do you feel confident with how people are behind this?
You know, I feel that people, as it stands, the majority of the people want the mayor to resign. And we have gotten a lot of support for the recall measure, yes. And people are calling all the time. People are emailing all the time saying that we support this and it's the right thing to do. It's good public policy. I think it is. It's, and as a legislator, we so often what we do is we legislate from behind and we're late on things and we're reactive to things instead of being proactive. That's why our government fails us, because we react. And this is, of course, some could say, well, this is a reaction. Well, we need to react because we learn from society how to make our how to make society better by reacting to things so that we don't make the same mistake twice.
Illinois State Representative LaShawn K. Ford from the 8th Legislative District. Happy holidays. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you. And I really appreciate the opportunity.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and represents Fortune 500 companies and small business and workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2014. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their continued growth is a result of their aggressive, results-oriented approach that their clients trust. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among our other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN. The following has been a paid advertisement by the firm of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff.
And welcome back, Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus, the final episode of 2015. And we welcome in two professors now on the phone, from Chapman University, Professor Ronald Rotunda, and from Northern Illinois College of Law, Professor Robert Jones. They're on to talk about Fisher versus the University of Texas, the affirmative action case in the U.S. Supreme Court. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Professor Jones, Associate Professor of Law at Northern Illinois University College of Law. You teach constitutional law, conflict of laws, antitrust, and evidence. Thanks so much for joining us. So could you tell our listeners just a quick background about what has gone on at the Supreme Court with affirmative action before the Fisher case?
Sure. Well, the key case, the two key cases were Bakke and Grutter. And in both of those cases, the Supreme Court essentially held that universities, public universities, of course, none of this applies to private universities because they're not bound by the Constitution on these issues. But for public universities, the issue is whether or not schools can take race into account when deciding who to admit. And so Grutter and Bakke both held that race could be considered as one of many factors, but only if it's one of many factors. It can't be a predominant factor, and it can't be used in any kind of rigid or inflexible way. But if the university is sophisticated, nuanced, and looks at a variety of different things when admitting its classes, race, they're not barred from considering race as one of many things when deciding what kind of class they want to admit. So that's essentially what happened before. Bakke was back, I think, in 1978. Grutter was more recent. I think it was 2003. So Grutter essentially upheld Bakke because Bakke was a split decision. So Grutter was 5-4 and essentially adopted the Bakke approach. But the author of Grutter and the key swing vote in the 5-4 decision was Justice O'Connor. Now she's gone. So that brings us to Fisher, and so Fisher.
So let's pick it up with Fisher. If we could bring Professor Ron Rotunda in. Professor Rotunda, you're the distinguished professor of jurisprudence at Chapman University. Literally wrote the book on constitutional law, at least the one that I studied in law school. So very happy to have you here on Legal
Face-Off. Thank you. I hope you bought a new copy.
It's still a little dog-eared, but it's in good shape. So let's talk about Fisher. So Abigail Fisher was a white student who claims that she was deprived of a place at the University of Texas because of race, correct?
Yeah, well, basically, you know, she said she wants to be considered under a race-neutral program. And the Texas legislature enacted one. Texas had this unfortunate experience with racial discrimination. And what they proposed, the law provided that you would automatically get into the University of Texas if you were in the top 10% of your high school class. And this benefits a lot of minorities who disproportionately live in poorer areas. And the poor areas are, you know, disproportionate minority. But there's always going to be 10% in the top 10% of the class. And Texas then got a fair number of racial minorities, particularly blacks and Hispanics. The University of Texas then said, well, we want to get more. We want to get more who are a bit smarter. And therefore, we want to have a program where we look at, Robert Jones says, we want to look at various things, including color, to make sure we get more blacks and Hispanics. And the case went up to the Supreme Court, about a year ago, and the court sent it back and said, you really haven't shown, you, Texas, have not shown why it's necessary to do this, since you have a program that already gets in a fair number of minorities. And what's peculiar about the case, also in the original case, Grutter, the O'Connor said that it's appropriate to get what she called a critical mass of minorities to find out, not that they think differently, they think just like the rest of us. And so Kennedy and Scalia and others are saying, well, you've already got your critical mass. Can you then also look at race? And that's the issue before the court now.
So let's talk about what actually garnered a lot of news and attention, actually, from the arguments besides the substance of it. Let's talk about Justice Scalia. Justice Scalia, during the oral arguments on December 9th, said that, I'll just read his quote so I don't misquote him. There are those who contend that it does not benefit African Americans to get them into the University of Texas, where they do not do well, as opposed to having them go to a less advanced school, a slower track school, where they do well. That resulted in a lot of outrage, a lot of accusations that Justice Scalia was being racist when he said that. Professor Jones, what about that? What do you think of Justice Scalia's statement during oral arguments?
Well, it's interesting. He doesn't really have a filter. That's what happens when you have life tenure for such a long time. You kind of say whatever pops in your head, I suppose. I think the remarks were a reflection of what he thinks. I think they were insensitive. I think it's also interesting because right after those remarks, he said, I don't think it's a good idea that Texas is just admitting as many blacks as it can. I don't think he really appreciates what Texas is trying to do. I don't think he really understands or appreciates the goal of Texas has when it's trying to admit a diverse class. I just don't think he sees much value in it to begin with, and I think that's where the remarks are coming from. I think a lot of people thought the remarks were troubling, and I think among the people who might think the remarks are troubling is Kennedy. He was sitting very close to him at the time the remarks were made. I think Kennedy's very much in equipoise in this case. My guess is that Kennedy himself hasn't even decided how he's going to vote yet. I mean, listening to the oral argument, I really can't tell which way he's going to go. And he couldn't decide with Fisher 1 how to rule, so I think he's probably still struggling. So I don't know. Maybe the remarks might actually have an impact on a variety of people. Maybe Kennedy will be one of them.
I'd like to say something 180 degrees different.
That's why we call it Legal Face-Off.
Yeah, even though it's virtual face-off because we're on the telephone. But you read the quote. Scalia says, referring to some briefs, says, there are those who contend that. And then he has the rest of the quote. And the New York Times, the New York Post, Senator Reid. A whole bunch of people said that's racist. I don't understand how it can be racist to raise an argument in the brief and then raised by Abigail Fisher and various amicus briefs and say, what's your response to that? Because that's a question that either side of this debate would like answered.
Well, the theory that
they would not said, there are those who say, and what do you think? I just think that's a perfectly fair answer, and since we have it on a transcript, I'm really, I guess if this were video, you'd see my jaw dropping for those who say this somehow shows that it's racist. He wanted an answer to the question that the other side raised in the litigation.
Well, the theory is this mismatch theory, right, that some people have put forth that suggests that minority students are inhibited by affirmative action because those who receive preferences learn less in the classroom than they would if they attended a school where their level of academic preparation was closer to the median student. I don't know. I'm not an expert at that, but it seems a little general to say that as a group, minority law students won't learn as much if they're put in the general population.
Well, see, he's referring to the briefs. If you go to the briefs, including several of them, cite a book, quote a book by UCLA law professor Richard Sander, who had been a very strong supporter of affirmative action. His book was published in 2002. He calls it mismatch. And he goes through a lot of statistics that suggest or indicate that minorities are the people that should be, if you want to put schools like in five tiers, you know, first, second, third, fourth, and fifth tier, that students who should be in the fourth tier are pushed into students should be in the second tier are pushed into the first. And then they think they're not as good as some of the others because the record is different. What they found, there was a study of MIT in the 1980s that the black students there scored in the top 10% nationally of the math portion of the SAT. That's really pretty good, you know, but it was the bottom 10% of their classmates at MIT when they graduated. The historically black colleges, which are less selective than the top tier, produce 40% of blacks with undergraduate degrees in math and science, but they only account for 20% of black enrollment. Well, Sander went through all these figures, and he said this is a problem. Another problem that has been raised is that it's called the soft bigotry of low expectations. When people see a black doctor, a lot of them say, well, he just got to be a doctor because it was affirmative action in the new medical school. And so now we have somebody like Ben Carson, who is a world-renowned brain surgeon. I mean, that's really pretty good. And what Trump calls him an okay doctor. This was the concern that a lot of people, say liberals, there was Clyde Sommer, who's 50 years ago, professor at Yale, and he's been a longtime critic of labor union discrimination against blacks. And he did his study, and he came to the same thing, that preferential admissions at the elite law schools, like the ones at Yale, he said, damaged the students at Yale. And that's a factual issue before the court. But it's not racist to ask about it, particularly when the one side in litigation is basing a lot on it. So you'd like to know what the answer is of the state of Texas, and their answer was a little vague.
All right, Professor Jones, where do you think the court goes with this case with Fisher versus University of Texas?
Real quick, may I just respond real briefly? I think it's important not to say that Scalia is being racist. I think there's some bias going on, but it may be implicit. But the comment I was referring to came right after the comments you quoted, where he said, "I don't think it's a good thing for the University of Texas to admit as many blacks as possible." And the point I was making is that statement I thought was troubling to me more than even the ones you quoted, because I think it shows a real lack of understanding or appreciation of what Texas is trying to do. Texas is not trying to admit every minority or a person of color that applies. They're trying to admit a diverse class, and they're only trying to admit those they feel are qualified for admission. So I do think there is this problem of assuming that a student who gets admitted who is a person of color isn't qualified. It's up to the school to decide who is qualified, and that's what All Texas is asking for, is the right to do that based on their own evaluation. So, that's sufficient.
All right.
I'm sorry, your question was?
Yeah, what's the court going to do? Both of you, in 30 seconds or less, what's the court going to do with Fisher?
Decide 5-4.
In favor of?
Decide 5-4 at the end of June, and I don't know which way. So you know I'll be right.
Professor Jones.
It can be 5-4 because Kagan has recused herself.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it's going to be 4-4 or 5-3. You're right.
I don't know. If it's 4-4, then that will in essence affirm the Fifth Circuit that upheld in the favor of Texas. So I don't know. It's hard to predict because I don't know if Kennedy knows. Kennedy wanted the case to be remanded for another trial. He wanted more facts. And Fisher's attorneys opposed the remand. And so I think, and also Fisher's attorneys are not really even pushing for an reversal of Grutter. Kennedy has never, ever voted in favor of a diversity program. He's always come out in favor of them in theory, but he's never, ever voted in favor of one in practice. So logically, you have to think this might lose. But my intuition is that he might go with the Democrats and rule 4-4, and it will be upheld. But it's very hard to say.
Professor Robert Jones from the NIU College of Law, Professor Ron Rotunda, Professor Dale E. Fowler School of Law at Chapman University. Thank you both for your time. I'm sure we'll talk to you in 2016.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
We are back, Legal Face-Off, WGN Plus, with Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. I am Sam Panionovich, and I have with me a transcript. It's, I don't know how old this transcript is. There are hundreds of pages. North Korea, International Law, and the Dual Crises. And the author in studio with us, Morris Tan, who's also a law professor at NIU. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Professor Tan, thank you for joining us. You're an expert, one of the foremost experts on North Korea, and specifically human rights violations and violation of international law. Tell us how North Korea has violated international law and how maybe that's not exactly what most people think of when they think of North Korea and some of the issues that have been brought up over the last few years.
Yes, North Korea is like one big jail of a country. You can't go in and out. You can't even move freely within North Korea. And within North Korea, though, you have the concentration camps. And in these concentration camps, you can imagine the worst of the concentration camps under Stalin or Mao or Hitler. And all these things and more are going on in North Korea. Not only that, unlike those other regimes, North Korea punishes by association three generations. So you can be punished for something that your grandfather did and therefore find yourself born in a concentration camp. I'll give you one example. I know sometimes you talk about sports. There was the World Cup team. I believe it was from the 1960s or early 70s that did very well from North Korea. They knocked off major European powers like Italy and Portugal and places like that. And they were apparently celebrating too much, according to the regime. And in response, they sent the soccer team to a concentration camp. And so there was a particular member of that team who was sent to an area of torture where he could not stand, he could not lie down, and he was there for 2 weeks, and nobody had ever survived for that long. But by the time he got out, he couldn't even stand. He just collapsed to the ground. But apparently, because of his athletic training, was able to last for a couple weeks there. But every manner of the worst form of torture that you could imagine is experienced by people in these concentration camps. Most people don't survive their terms.
I saw an interesting documentary where a journalist was smuggled in with a doctor from, I think, Africa, who is an optometrist. So he was allowed to come into the country, do eye surgeries and procedures. So they had cameras and the equipment, and they were able to document it. But these people were so brainwashed, when they were done with the surgery, they had the patches removed, they were in a big room, and there was a portrait of the leader up there. And they cried and wailed and kept saying that it was the leader that healed them. And
that's
correct. That true? How are they that brainwashed?
Yes, the whole society is full of propaganda elevating the three Kims. And believe it or not, legally, if you are escaping from your residence, which is burning down, you are legally obligated to run back into the burning inferno to rescue the pictures of the Kim supreme rulers that are there. There was a child who scrawled with a crayon on one of these pictures, and the whole family was sent to a concentration camp on that basis. And so, unfortunately, this is the most totalitarian place on planet Earth, and they have this sort of deification of the three Kims.
What can be done about North Korea? Is there any intervention that can take place in order to depose the leader or have him, you know, removed?
I think there's a lot that could be done. In Appendix 2 of the book, I list a lot of organizations that are doing good work with respect to North Korea. I think cultural exchanges, educational sorts of things are all positive humanitarian efforts. But I also think there are legal accountability measures that can be taken. And at the conference, it was said that these are the types of things that are most concerning to North Korea. And in the book, I talk about the possibility of a hybrid tribunal, which is part domestic, part international, to try those who are most responsible for the most heinous atrocities in North Korea. David Sheffer, who wrote the preface for the book, he proposes that South Korea could consider North Korean nationals to be South Korean nationals, and therefore it might be possible to prosecute them in South Korea as Korean citizens. And like the Sierra Leone tribunal, it might be possible to do it in absentia.
Professor Morris Tan from Northern Illinois University College of Law, speaking about North Korea, international law, and the dual crisis. I was struck by a portion of your book dealing with some of the prisons in North Korea. We've talked on this show, a Legal Face-Up, before about the prison system in this country. From the Hell's Doorstep portion of your book, I'm going to read this, that an individual testified that on one occasion, the commander of his unit raped a woman who became pregnant and gave birth to a baby. The mother and her child were taken to the detention and punishment block, where the baby was thrown in the feeding bowl for the dogs. Is this representative of the type of things that go on, especially for female prisoners in North Korea?
Unfortunately, yes. And North Korea engages in genocidal patterns, in that they will systematically destroy any babies who are not fully Korean. And also, when women are raped, which is common in these concentration camps, it is the women who are punished, not the people in the concentration camp who had engaged in the crime.
So we talk a lot about the show about due process. You know, we enjoy in this country, as in most Western democracies, lots of rights, especially when it comes to the legal system. What is the legal system like in North Korea? If you're arrested, sounds like you're arrested often for, you know, ridiculous things. But if you're arrested, do you have the right to a lawyer that we enjoy here? Do you have the right to any kind of due process? How soon do you see a judge? Could you sort of take us a little bit into how that process works?
Yeah, there is a criminal code in North Korea. Unfortunately, it's not followed very much. But even the criminal code itself is deficient in various ways, and there's nothing like due process. Oftentimes, it's a summary, cursory sort of process. Judges oftentimes are pronouncing sentences that have been preordained by politically by the higher-ups in the regime. And they are punished and executed for things like a little girl stealing a kernel of corn who is starving, a woman singing a South Korean pop song was grounds, disco dancing was grounds for capital punishment, and they gather crowds of people to send a warning to the rest of the populace that unless they too don't stay in line, they too could suffer a comparable fate.
How many times were you just left speechless by some of the things that you uncovered with this book? I mean, he already read an excerpt about one of them, but I can't even imagine some of the things that you had to learn about.
Frequently. It's horrifying. It's hard to, it's nightmarish. It makes 1984, the Orwellian nightmare, look pretty good by comparison. And so it is hard to fathom that there could be a place on planet Earth, that this is not fiction, that this is actually happening to real people there. It is horrifying, and I am dismayed time and again in the research. It's challenging to do it.
Professor Tan, Syria is also very much in the news, literally as we speak, with everything that's going on with ISIS and ISIL. You draw a line between Syria and North Korea, yes?
That's correct.
Tell us about that underground connection that you have written extensively about.
Well, North Korea is a proliferator of weapons, and including weapons of mass destruction, and they do so to all sorts of hands that we should not want these weapons to be under, and that includes Syria. So Syrian tanks that Syria has been using, underground bunker technology that Syria has employed, including in its recent conflict with Israel, the nuclear program that they had that was destroyed by the Israeli Air Force. All these things came from North Korea.
The book is North Korea, International Law, and the Dual Crises. NIU Law Professor Morris Tan, are you rooting for the Huskies tonight?
Of course.
Yeah, the Huskies. Well, actually, this is going to be on the 18th, right? It's going to be after...
Oh, yeah, you're right, probably.
Right. It's going to be the next week. Okay. One more time. The book is North Korea, International Law, and the Dual Crises, and the author is Morris Tan, Professor of Law at Northern Illinois University. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back, Legal Face-Off on WGN+. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, and you can always find us, of course, on iTunes, as we have a new part of the team, the monthly segment now, a husband-wife-lawyer combo, Tina Martini and David Sussler, with us now on WGN+. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good morning.
Welcome back. We appreciate having you both to talk about your latest Inside Out column from Chicago Lawyer Magazine. This column is about change management, correct?
Yes.
What is change management? Tina?
It is the process by which change is implemented, usually by an organization, taking a look at short and long-term goals, figuring out what needs to change from the status quo and how you get to that point where the change is implemented.
Tina Martini, you're with DLA Piper. You are chair of the Chicago Intellectual Property Practice Group. At that firm, you also sit on the executive committee. So change is part of your daily existence, right? Especially when it comes to the executive committee. I can only imagine the intricacies of that, being at a smaller firm myself. How do you deal with the amount of change that goes on at a big firm like DLA Piper?
Well, I would say that there's a lot of change in the profession, both small firm as well as large firm. And I would say that a lot of it is just figuring out where our clients are, first and foremost, as businesses and geographically, and then figuring out what segment of the market we as a business are trying to attract. And then sort of working from there, figuring out how we... what we're doing well, what we need to do differently, and like any organization, figuring out a process or a roadmap for getting there. And so whether it's figuring out how to get new business or what types of clients to attract, it's figuring out how you can align your talent and your business model with that.
David Sussler, you're Associate General Counsel with National Material LP, manufacturing company here in Illinois. You are a resident expert when it comes to talking about how inside counsel, what they look for in outside counsel. So tell me, what quality do you look for in outside counsel with regards to how they deal with change?
Well,
that's quite a long. That's quite an intro, wasn't it?
you know, we've written in our column about being a trusted advisor and a confidant. And when it comes to change management, when you're talking more on an organizational, structural level, having an outside counsel who truly is a trusted advisor and someone with a lot of business sense as well as legal sense, those are the types of outside counsel I would go to in this situation. You know, for example, change management may often involve employment shifts. So you may want to consult somebody who has the substantive expertise, but also the practical advice. Or if you're an IP, if you have an IP situation, you're managing an IP portfolio, you go to somebody like Tina, who not only has the IP substance, but has management experience as well and an understanding of organizational growth and change. So that's what I would look for in this context.
How important is it, Tina, to deal with change not only substantively, but also quickly? I mean, how important is the speed to which you adapt with change an important process in change management?
I think it depends on what you're looking to change, both the substance of the change as well as the impacted parties. If you're looking to make a pretty fundamental change that will impact the whole organization, for example, there's the figuring out what the change needs to be, the process by which you're going to get there short-term and long-term. And then I think when it comes to getting the buy-in from the folks who are impacted, if you've got a very large organization, you have to be very strategic and methodical about how you're going to get the buy-in that you need in order to make the change work and really stick. So I think there are certain instances where you have to move pretty quickly where you're not going to be able to have the time to do stuff like getting the buy-in. But for the most part, when you're shifting something pretty fundamentally, the earlier you start that process, the better. And you have to build in the time, the lead time necessary to get the grassroots support, so to speak.
David, you hire lots of, maybe not lots, but you hire outside counsel. I know that when I'm reporting to a client, what's very important to them when change happens is not only what that change was, what the facts were that changed, but the bigger picture is really what I'm being paid for, which is how that change affects the overall strategy of the case, how it affects our plan of action, how it affects budgeting, things like that. Do you agree that the change itself is sometimes not as important as how that change affects these other issues?
Yes, I would agree with that. And how that change is managed is extremely important, which really comes down to communication, letting me know that a change is coming and why and how it'll happen. If I hear that from my outside counsel before I have to call and ask about it, I'm much happier.
And as attorneys, we're all looking for more clients. I think we all do it in different ways. Me being a plaintiff's attorney, you know, we're always looking to market in that. How important is it to react to that change where you guys would have probably one client that sends you multiple files? If that client stops, what do you guys do, you know, to work with that change in the marketing strategy?
You mean in terms of if we like lose a client,
yeah,
or a certain revenue flow?
Yeah, and how would you, as a big firm, how would you react to that?
Well, I mean, I think that, again, I think this answer would probably be the same pretty much across any type of firm. If for some reason that type of thing happens, you have to sort of, and we had talked about this in our last spot here a few weeks ago, is deconstructing what happened and figuring out, okay, well, is this something that we actually can shift and maybe change back? Or is this something that is gone, in which case trying to figure out what we could have done differently, maybe had a different result, and then going forward, maybe adjusting our approach, whether it's an onboarding of a client change or whether it's a management of the client type of change. But a big part, I think, of everybody in the legal profession right now being able to be successful is being nimble and reacting to information that you get and other types of, you know, just circumstances, what happens and what can you do differently to react to that. But you do have to react very quickly. And I think a big part of being successful is not just reacting, but being proactive and trying to really be careful and thinking about how other people view a particular situation so that you can avoid that situation in the first place.
So, David, in your column at Inside Out column, November 2015, Chicago Lawyer, you talk about outside counsel teaming with people like you to help drive change within a company. I often face that situation when I think that my clients might be able to do things differently. How do you suggest that an outside counsel like me really helps drive that change? And do you think that some companies would see that as maybe too invasive and not the role of outside counsel?
I think that I appreciate it, and I would think whether your client is an in-house lawyer or an in-house business person, any such client would appreciate the direct advice and input of outside counsel and not see it as threatening. Now, depending on if your client is an in-house lawyer or a business person, you might have to phrase it a little bit differently. But we being in-house lawyers and our business clients, who are the business leaders, we want to manage risk appropriately. And if you, as our trusted outside counsel, see something that could help us going forward in managing our risk and making a change, I always appreciate direct advice. And all the business leaders I've dealt with in all three of the companies I've been in-house counsel for appreciate that advice. So be direct.
Tina Martini in the studio, David Sussler on the phone with us, Legal Face-Off, WGN Plus. I ask the hard-hitting questions, so I want to know if there's a competition between the two of you on who can be busier. Because you're married, you obviously you have a column together. I mean, you guys must never sleep.
David, do you want to take? Do you want to pick that one up?
No.
David, why don't you pick that one up? Want to kick that one?
Yeah,
up?
Sorry. No, there's no competition. Yeah, we're both very busy. You know, the nature of our jobs are a bit different. Being an in-house attorney versus being a private practice attorney who has to bill per hours. So we're actually, you know, in our personal lives, we're very supportive and complementary to each other in helping each of us get what needs to be done in our personal lives and our professional lives, to getting it done.
Is that accurate?
I would say it is accurate.
What if you said no? That would that would make for great radio.
Hence, Legal Face-Off.
Yes.
I work a lot of weekends, and I find David to be very supportive. I mean, he really runs the house in addition to having a very busy job. And I'd say that we do complement each other in terms of, and we are supportive. And it ebbs and flows, right? I mean, there are times when he's on the road a lot and I'm home, and when I'm on the road a lot and he's home, and we just sort of figure it out.
One question that I want to raise with regard to change in your column is one major change that we all face in both law firms and companies like David's is turnover, employees. How is that kind of change, turnover, expensive? Could you explain how that is expensive for a firm, for a company? And can you also talk about how the best way to deal, or what the best way to deal with change, that kind of change, is from the employee's perspective? How do you recommend that we deal with that?
I mean, I'm happy to take that up from a firm perspective. I would say that it's expensive when you lose folks, particularly those that have been with your firm for a while, because you make an investment in them, particularly to train them. And they end up helping you develop client relationships. And so when folks decide to take another course and to leave their place of employment, then there's a cost associated with that. And I'd say, just in terms of what you do after that, from the perspective of the employer, I can say that when, you know, oftentimes people just make life decisions. And we talked about decision making in the last session. People make decisions because their lives change, and that drives change in things like careers. And so what I recommend and what we try to do is, when we lose folks for whatever reason, oftentimes they'll go to clients, for example, is to take a look and say, okay, well, is there anything we could do differently going forward to try to minimize the likelihood of somebody leaving next time? And there's a realignment that happens. Sometimes there's things you can interview for that maybe you didn't interview for before. Sometimes it's just an alignment of expectations and that sort of thing. But that's how we typically approach those sorts of things.
And, you know, it's exactly the same for us, for me in my practice, for us as a business, and there's kind of two, in my mind, I divide it into two categories. One is sort of the day-to-day issues with employees that may arise versus the planned reorganization or mass layoffs that one might face, say, in a recession. In the mass layoffs that you may have to have, there's a lot of advanced planning that goes into the process, and you have to think about it both from the legal standpoint and the human standpoint. And then on the day-to-day issue, one of the things I talk about a lot to help with the planning and to avoid issues is that companies are in business to keep their employees, not to lose them, because it is very expensive, both in hard dollars from having to recruit and train to replace them, and the soft costs of losing the institutional knowledge and the time. So you really try to avoid that, and that's an ongoing process that I approach in having conversations and doing training and helping to set a mindset to create the right kind of workplace where everybody wants to work and can work and be successful.
We'll let you out of here, David and Tina, with this hard-hitting question from Legal Face-Off. David and I are huge Bruce Springsteen fans. Tina probably is, only because you have to be married to David.
I wouldn't say because I have to be. I was a Bruce fan before then.
How many shows? That's the
had I seen before David?
Yes.
Zippo.
How many post-David?
I don't know, David. Probably. Well, the first show was 1999, I believe. So that's 16, 17 years ago. So how many has it been? At least 15 or so?
At least 15 together.
So yeah. Tell us, David, in about 30 seconds, your most infamous Bruce Springsteen story. I know it well, but so many years
ago. Well, when my first Springsteen show, October 18th, 1980, Kiel Opera House, St. Louis, met him after the show, and I said to him, I'm an 18-year-old kid, and I said to him, "That was a great show. I'm in euphoria." And I'm thinking to myself, what a stupid thing to
euphoria.
Say.
Euphoria. What a cool rock word to use with Springsteen.
Security.
Yeah, well,
stalker.
Bruce looks at me and smiles, and he says, "Yeah, that's what we like to hear."
And then he said, "Never let this guy near me again."
Yeah, well, that was just before we followed his tour bus to the hotel.
Well, he just announced, 15 or 20 dates, so got to up that total for both of you.
Yes, I've had to manage the change in my schedule today by the distraction of knowing the tour's coming up and tickets go on sale in a week.
Tina Martini from DLA Piper, David Sussler from National Material LP. They're married, they're busy, but there's no competition. They have a column, Chicago Lawyer Magazine, chicagolawyermagazine.com, and you can hear them once a month here on Legal Face-Off. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Be sure to listen to Legal Face-Off on iTunes, Facebook, Legal Face-Off, Twitter, at The Legal Face-Off. You can always tell a friend as we close out the show with Rich Lankoff and Jason Whiteside. It's The Legal Grab Bag. Four topics to get to before we spring you for Christmas. And we'll start with the Freddie Gray jury. It's deadlocked.
Last grab bag of the year, my friends, right? Breaking news right now is the Freddie Gray trial. There was one officer in Baltimore, William Porter, who was the first one tried. The jury initially was deadlocked yesterday, and now the report is that they're a hung jury, which means that they cannot decide on the guilt or innocence of the officer. So basically that will be a mistrial. They're not able to complete the trial. It was interesting for a number of reasons. Usually the judge doesn't allow a hung jury this quickly. So yesterday was when we first heard that the jury was deadlocked. Deadlocked means, as the name implies, they can't come to a decision. Not uncommon in trials, but the judge will usually send the jury back and tell them, figure it out. You're not going to, we can't let you be deadlocked. And then today, there's a hung jury. So usually the judge will force them to deliberate for a lot longer than 24 hours before the judge allows a hung jury. The other interesting component to this was it probably validates the criticism of the district attorney who really pushed this case to trial really quickly. So everyone remembers that Freddie Gray was arrested. He was put in the back of a police van, and he wasn't wearing a seatbelt while he was being transported. This was a 25-year-old African-American, and he was shackled, but he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. And the allegation against the officers was that because they didn't put him in a seatbelt, then he died as a result. And it's really unusual for this kind of murder charge by the omission of an officer. It's not like in the Laquan McDonald case where, you know, there was a shooting. In this case, the allegation was that because the officers didn't do something, that resulted in enough to charge them with murder. Again, the DA went really quickly, quicker than most people thought. So maybe it's an indictment of acting too quickly in these kind of cases.
It looks like this thing might be another couple of weeks or months before resolution, right? I mean, this has gone on forever, and yet we still don't have a final answer.
Well, this case is over.
Well, wait, what do you mean?
There is a next step.
I mean, there's more. I mean, this case will be over.
They could potentially retry the case, but it's going to be expensive. They have to pick a new jury. So I don't know what the rates are for retrials, but in this case, it doesn't look like they'll have one.
Yeah, I mean, they'll appear in court. They might. It just depends on whether the prosecution thinks that it is worth trying again. Who knows? I suspect they won't because, again, I think they went a little too quickly in this case. But there's five other officers besides Porter who were charged, so we'll see what happens with their trials.
We move to Massachusetts now, where a jury has found Philip Chisholm guilty of first-degree murder in the 2013 killing of his high school math teacher, Colleen Ritzer.
Yeah, at the time of the killing, Philip Chisholm was only 14 years old. He tried to argue an insanity defense, but there was the jury ruled that he was sane to stand trial and ultimately found him guilty. There was a chilling video, too, though, that showed him kind of, you know, walking around the hallway and lurking, poking his head in and out of the teacher's classroom and then looking down the hall. And then it didn't help that they found the box cutter that he used to cut, slice her throat and cut her. They found mask, gloves, and a hooded sweatshirt all in his backpack. So it's a sad story out of Massachusetts, but not surprising conclusion.
Yeah, he was, 14, right?
Yeah, 14 when he committed the act.
So we've talked on the show before about minors being tried for murder. This was certainly another example of that happening.
Yeah, the defense was trying to argue, and they had, of course, a psychologist to argue that he was hearing voices and he was not of sane mind at the time he committed the act, but the jury didn't buy it and found him guilty.
How common is it for a psychologist to declare somebody legally insane or practically insane and that actually stands up in court?
You can buy an opinion to, you know, that'll say that. I mean, it's just about money. It's just whether or not the jury actually believes whatever, even in civil work, whether or not they believe the expert that you hire. But there's people out there that you can pay enough money to that'll come into court and testify on your behalf. But the insanity defense, I don't know what the statistics are. Maybe Rich does. The insanity plea or the defense at trial is so ineffective, and it's rarely ever used. I don't know what the rates are, but I remember it's really, really low.
Yeah, I don't know what the rates are either, but I mean, a lot of people, I think, misunderstand the insanity defense criminally. I mean, the question isn't whether you're insane or not. That's not the standard. The standard is whether you can understand the difference between right and wrong, whether you can understand and take responsibility for your actions. If you can, regardless of whether, you know, you have some other mental condition, then, your insanity defense won't work. The other interesting thing about this case is that he was tried as an adult, like we talked about. He faces a maximum of life in prison as an adult. If he was tried as a juvenile, according to a couple of Supreme Court cases, he cannot receive a life sentence. So, interesting.
Peter Francis Teresi, who I think put me to sleep like 30 times on TV with those awful commercials, him and his wife were suing their neighbors at their River North condo, and one of the situations involves them not being able to lock their neighbor's dogs out of the elevator.
Yeah, everyone knows Peter Francis Teresi. billboards, info tapes, info CDs. He's moved throughout, I think, since the 80s. But he has a he also has a, another lawsuit, too, that the Illinois Appellate Court allowed him. He purchased a 6,000-square-foot penthouse at the top of the Ritz-Carlton residence. But there's an interesting wrinkle. A Mexican billionaire had already put dibs on the penthouse, too, and had a right of first refusal. So they're in litigation now to see whether or not Peter Francis Dracy actually paid a proper amount, which would include a deposit on the purchase price, and whether this Mexican billionaire was screwed out of the property. But the court ruled that he wasn't, and Peter Francis Dracy is able to take ownership of the 6,000-square-foot penthouse that he purchased for $8.6 million.
Set a record in Chicago for... Yeah.
Square footage price.
Yeah.
Was $1,342 a square foot.
Top of the Ritz-Carlton. That's Whiteside money. But the other interesting thing about the lawsuit, I don't know if it's the same lawsuit or a different one, but his wife is claiming PTSD from,
it was from
dogs in the elevator.
That's from a previous lawsuit. Guy knows how to sue. But they sued the condo board from a neighbor's dog, and she's saying she has post-traumatic stress disorder after being attacked by
brutally attacked,
dog.
Right?
Yeah.
By a dog walker in the elevator.
Yeah. And then she tried to lock him out of the elevator, and they wouldn't let her, so she went to the condo board.
Yeah,
I have three words. Rich people problems.
Yeah.
And last but certainly not least on the Grab Bag Legal Face-Off on WGN+, Star Wars The Force Awakens released this week. I don't know if you guys were at the midnight showing. I was not. Watercott was.
I saw Watercott dressed as Chewie.
He was dressed as Leia.
Oddly enough, he wasn't wearing anything. He was just shirtless. He wasn't wearing a shirt that day.
A hair sweater.
But there
just a Stormtrooper thong.
Yeah.
That's it.
When Lucasfilm sold the rights to J.J. Abrams, we thought maybe lawsuits might come up. There are certainly some lawsuits, and they kind of range from all different directions.
By the way, I saw George Lucas on the street a couple weeks ago. So he sold, this is not the legal story, but he sold the rights to Star Wars for $6 billion, right?
$4
billion. To whom?
I thought it was six. Four or six.
Yeah.
They're estimating that they're going to make, what, like $3 billion on this movie alone? Like, good move.
You know what, though? If I got $6 billion
to pay
taxes,
I probably wouldn't worry too much about it.
And you got $4 billion rolling around in your pocket. Plus, he's made so much money.
Yeah, it's
a
true.
Boo-hoo, missed out on $1 billion.
Well, then anyway. He sold the rights, and then he wanted to still advise on the film, and they were like, no.
Well, he still went to the premiere. I saw him at the premiere. Not personally, of course, on TV. Interesting. Some interesting intellectual property lawsuits that we dug up that relate to Star Wars. Over the years, Lucasfilm and then Disney have been very protective, obviously, of their intellectual property that deals with this multi-billion dollar brand. Dating back to the Reagan years. So Reagan had a famous defense program called SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, that he coined Star Wars. And back in 85, Lucasfilm sued High Frontier, that was part of the Star Wars program, to stop using the phrase Star Wars. The court, however, found in Reagan's favor, saying that politicians, newspapers, and the public generally use the phrase Star Wars for convenience, and that people wouldn't confuse the two. So that was one interesting one. Another one was they tried to protect the word, Lucasfilm tried to protect the word droids. So I thought droids was sort of a generic
term.
Yeah, but he, back in 2009, Lucasfilm actually registered the trademark after Verizon came out with their droid phone. They trademarked the word droid. Of course, you know, famous droids in Star Wars. But the term droid, according to our crack research here at WGN Plus, goes back to 1952. In a short story called Robots of the World Arise.
Yeah, we got helmets, the Stormtrooper helmet, which pretty popular. There was a lawsuit involving the designer who molded the first Stormtrooper helmets for Star Wars back in 1977. He went on to a lucrative career of trying to still make those and sell those on the open market. And in 2006, a California court found that he was guilty of copyright infringement and owed George Lucas $20 million. So that's why George doesn't care about the billions he's going to lose on Star Wars. Eventually, this went to the British Supreme Court, and they ruled that they were functional props, meaning that he was able to continue to manufacture the replica helmets and did not have to pay Mr. Lucas any money.
One last one that we found was in 2014, Lucasfilm sued a small New York brewer called Empire. They had a beer called Strikes Bock. Get it? Empire Strikes Bock. They said that using that term could confuse consumers. Ironic, of course, because Lucas owns many vineyards called Skywalker Vineyards. So protecting the brand, making more money off Star Wars. Well, Sam, you got a good...
I just want to add one more. Rich doesn't want me to talk about this copyright because it hits close to home, but there's a Princess Leia hologram that says... It says, "Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope." Rich had it changed to, "Help me, Rich Lankov. You're my only hope."
I did.
And with that, we say goodbye for 2015. We'll see you in 2016. Happy holidays from all of us here at Legal Face-Off. We'll talk to you soon.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.